You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, May 18th, 2011, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Uvaitaan to all our friends in Finland.
Finland?
Finland.
Finland?
Finland, yes. Finland. Finland. And when you go to read it off a map, it says Finland, right? When you're learning it as a
the
kid.
The land of Finns.
Exactly.
Rebecca is not with us this evening. She is on the West Coast celebrating the end of the world.
Oh, yeah.
Wish I could be there.
We'll miss you, Rebecca.
Which we'll get to in a minute, but
what
first...
happens next week?
Yeah, Evan, what is special about this day?
May 21st, 1916, daylight savings time was introduced in Britain as a wartime measure to save fuel. This was not the first time that daylight savings was enacted, nor the first time it was thought of. Actually, original roots traces back to Benjamin Franklin, who had some very sketchy kind of thoughts about it, but basically came up with the concept of if you were to move the clocks, you would be able to save certain amount of light and energy in candle
usage. Good old Ben.
He measured it in candle usage. Like, imagine the candles you'll save over the course of a season of daylight savings.
Yeah, it's true. It makes no sense to be sleeping when the light is out. That's wasted daylight.
It is wasted. This is actually a pretty involved and relatively complex subject. Not only the origins of daylight saving time, but how it evolved over time and how it has kind of become this fractured sort of practice around the globe, in which there are places that do it now and currently maintain doing it. There are some that no longer do it but used to do it, and there are places on the earth that never did it. And there are these little pockets of holdouts around the world in which North America, for the most part, recognizes it, but there are certain parts, and part of the state of Arizona and parts of Canada don't change their clocks. So it can really mess with people in lots of different ways, you know, physically, economically.
Imagine if you live next to a state that didn't do it, and you got to commute there for your job, and you know you're going in and out of sync. You know, either one or 2 hours out of sync with them. It's like, that must be really
it always odd. Screws us up when we're doing interviews with people in other time zones. Especially countries. So you calculate like how many hours front or back they are, but then it's off by an hour because we shifted into daylight savings time or something, and then our schedule's all screwed up.
I knew people who would wear two watches when they would be in situations in which they would either travel a lot or would be in a case where they lived in one time zone, worked in another time zone, and of course the daylight savings thing as well. They just had two watches.
You know, I have to admit, I totally understand why we do it. It does make a lot of sense. There's other reasons why we still do daylight savings, but I hate it. I hate switching the time.
Oh, come on.
I really do.
Getting that extra hour of sleep is awesome.
Well, that one day a year? How about the hour that gets robbed from us?
That sucks, too.
So what happens if somebody, say, gets murdered right during that time when it switches?
They get a free pass.
No, I mean, what do the cops say? What time was it? You know, I don't know. I don't know.
Depends what Officer Klumsky says at the time. What do you think, Clancy? I don't know. Let's head to the bar. Okay.
Oh, boy.
All right. Well, we do have to move on quickly because the end of the world is upon us. May 21st, 2011. Is the rapture, when all of the good Christians will be taken up by God to live in bliss forever, in his glory, which sounds kind of nice.
That's cool.
And everyone else will be left back on earth to live through the end times, which will be like hell on earth.
All right, so as you're listening to this, today's the day of rapture. Nobody knows what time it's going to happen. I haven't really read anyone say it's going to happen at noon or whenever. Like, they're kind of leaving that open. What is very funny about it is that tons of people are throwing rapture parties. And one of the things I found out that was even more interesting was that one of the people's blogs I read, the guy said, whether you believe in it or not, come to the party because you're either going to, you know, get pulled out of the party or not. You know what I mean? So come anyway.
It's a win-win.
Yeah. And real quick, in case you guys don't know what the rapture is, I know everyone on the show does, but The rapture is when Jesus comes back to earth for judgment day. So God will pull everyone off the earth that's been faithful, that believes in him, or whatever the criteria is. And then Jesus will come back and, I guess we could say, wreak havoc on the people that are left over, and the devil comes and all that.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
Sounds like a
it's supposed
movie.
To be really kick-ass.
It's the Pocketclipse.
Shouldn't there have been an Antichrist sighting by now, though? You know, isn't he kind of
apparently, according
involved?
To the same cult. So this is all based upon the doomsday cult of Harold Camping, who has the radio show called FamilyRadio.com. You can go to the site and read how he came up with this date. It's basically numerology. It's biblical numerology. He says, oh, well, we know that Noah's flood happened in 4990 BC, and you know, in the Bible it says that a day is like 1,000 years, and God says the flood's coming in 7 days. And not only did he mean the Noah's flood was coming in 7 days, but the end of the world was coming in 7,000 years. 4990 plus 7,000 equals 2011. Now, how did he come up with May 21st? This is like really good numerology. He goes through this long, rambling explanation for why certain numbers are important in the Bible. And it's basically just, you know, pulling out number references that are given in the Bible. This guy's like, you know, free associating, you know, in a pretty psychotic way throughout this article. You should really read it. And then he, like, so the numbers 5, 10, and 17 are important in the Bible, you know, because there's 5 of something somewhere in the Bible, therefore it's important.
And then I-17.
If you do 5 times 10 times 17 twice, mm-hmm. for good measure, you come up with 722,500. If you take 722,500 days from April 1st, 33 AD, which is when Jesus Christ died, then you get to May 21st, 2011. There you go. How can you?
Oh, that's it.
It's proof. I mean, how can you argue with that kind of exquisite numerology? I mean, there you go.
You can't. You really
wow. He predicted a judgment day in the 90s.
Well, you know, he hadn't perfected the math that, you know, at that point.
Right.
He forgot to carry the two.
Well, you know, for me, you know, this is all the preamble. This is all just whatever for me. What I'm waiting for is a 22nd. And I just can't wait to hear the rationalizations of these people. What are they going to say? Are they going to say, you know, they could say the calculation was wrong, it's going to happen in 3 months, 6 months, whatever. Or something else might happen, and they might just not make any more predictions. And I just can't wait to see, you know, what the reaction is going to be. To me, that's what's going to be really fun.
What I'm not looking forward to potentially hearing about is that some part of this cult or some cult somewhere that has bought into this is going to decide to make that the end of their time for themselves or for others. And
yeah, definitely.
I really hope that doesn't happen, but you know, we might see that.
Yeah, like a Heaven's Gate type of deal.
Yeah.
You know,
I didn't think of that.
I wouldn't put it past that happening. You know, I think it's definitely possible, if not likely, especially with the more press that's happening with this. But overall, I think it's just going to be, you know, a half a day of embarrassment and then back to normal.
Yeah, well, what I think is going to happen is that they're collectively going to say, huh, this disconfirming evidence proves that we were wrong. We have to reconsider our entire worldview. Well, actually, that's not going to happen. What they're going to do is what they always do, which is rationalize and what's called cognitive dissonance reduction. They'll say one of a few things, that the end of the world has been postponed, that there was a misinterpretation somewhere along the line. And given, you know, how ridiculously, you know, interpretive the whole thing is, there's lots of room to lots of wiggle room in there. It's all made up BS anyway. Or that the actions of the cult caused the either delay or the postponing or even the avoiding of the doomsday. I don't think there, I don't know, it's kind of hard for the latter bit, because they're saying this is not just, oh, something bad's going to happen and God could decide to put it off. This is supposed to be the fulfillment of everything, you know. This is Revelations. This is the end of time. This is the second coming of Christ. It's hard to say that it was called off. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that wouldn't.
Well, it could have been
really
called off for good behavior, Steve.
I mean, I think the only thing they could say is that they misinterpreted the numerology. I think that's probably what they're going to go for.
All right, enough of the serious stuff. Let me get to some of the funny things I found, okay? I'm not going to name the blog, but one of the found, the person was saying the most prominent sign of Judgment Day was the earthquake that happened in Japan and the subsequent nuclear meltdown that followed. And it continues on, dead bodies of victims from the earthquake are still being discovered among the wreckage. This is very much like what the apocalypse could be like. And this is just a small preview of what the end of times will look like here on Earth. And then he says in the next paragraph, and you're going to love this, Steve, do you know Jesus? If the answer is no, then you must subscribe to my blog. Mm-hmm. And which he later on says, you know, I'll be updating it, so, you know, to teach you how to survive the coming apocalypse, how to be a part of the rapture. And this other awesome thing I found, somebody made an app, of course, called the Rapture Detector. Oh. What he says is,
only works up till a certain date.
This is the Rapture Detector. It's for 99 cents, the iTunes library. Partying and wild living can be yours again with Reverend Billy Joe Estes, Holy Manifestation House of Worship Rapture Detector. That's right. You heard it correctly. A Rapture Detector. 30 minutes prior to the rapture, you will be notified on your phone device, and you will have 30 minutes to run down to your local preacher and be saved. Hallelujah.
Or, you know, you also might want to pull over your car so you don't get raptured out of your car and kill other people. You know, you could be thoughtful.
Say goodbye to your dog.
Be killing heathens. I mean, it doesn't really matter at that point.
I guess that's true.
Hey, guys, I talked to a born-again Christian about this just to get her take on this. And it was kind of odd to be in kind of superficial agreement about something wacky with this person. But of course, then she kind of went off the rails and was saying stuff like, well, you know, it can't be real. This can't be the rapture because of two things. And basically, one is that the Bible explicitly says that man can't know when it's going to happen. So it's impossible to deduce it, to infer it, to whatever, to figure out when it's going to happen. So that kind of shoots that one in the foot. And the other one was that clearly the end times today, the environment today, doesn't match the end times as they were predicted in the Bible. So all these things can't come to fruition because, you know, they don't match. There's no match. So
environmental concerns,
so clearly that the rapture's a fake for those two reasons.
Yeah.
Well, to summarize this, everyone that is being raptured, rapture carefully.
Please rapture responsibly. But I do think it was interesting that the non-believer community decided to respond to this by basically having parties, having rapture parties. I think that's a good way.
I love it.
Yeah,
to
softly ridicule it, because it doesn't really need to be deconstructed or ridiculed that much. It's kind of, unless you're in the cult, it's pretty patently absurd. So it's a good way to make fun of it while promoting maybe a more rational worldview.
I've wasted my life.
Well, if the world doesn't end, you'll be happy to know that we've found another cure for cancer.
Oh.
What cures cancer?
Yeah, what cures cancer?
Little cancers.
Apparently this does.
Apparently scientists have cured cancer, but nobody cares.
Yeah, but Steve, those pharmaceutical companies don't want you to be healthy.
That's right.
Yeah, they don't make money off of healthy people.
Yeah, they wouldn't make money off of a cancer cure. I mean, you cure them and then they won't come back for more cancer. I mean,
well, you got to give
obviously,
them the cancer in the first place, right?
I mean, really, how much money could you possibly make off of a cancer cure? It's just not a viable business.
Yeah, you only make hundreds of billions. I mean, you know, that's chump change. Okay, but seriously, this is an old story that has cropped up again because somebody posted it on Facebook and it went viral. So we got 100 emails about it, you know, people linking to this story. It's just an urban legend that poked its head up again. This is the story of DCA. This is a legitimate drug that is actually already approved for other indications. And it does actually have an interesting potential mechanism of action. The background story is that some cancers, like 50, 60% of cancers, will shift their energy production from aerobic to anaerobic glycolysis. So because tumors often outgrow their blood supply or they have limited blood supply, it's hard to it's hard for them to get enough oxygen from the blood to produce all the energy they need by burning oxygen. So some tumor cells will shift into anaerobic glycolysis, where they'll get energy out of just burning glucose without oxygen. What DCA does, or dichloroacetate does, is it shifts, it forces the mitochondria to shift back to oxygen-using state, and that can trigger apoptosis. It can trigger the cell to die.
Cell death.
Oh. Yeah. All very interesting. It's a sort of a new approach to cancer, taking a metabolic approach. So it all sounds good. Looks good on paper, right? You know, some good preliminary data to show that it's a plausible and reasonable line of research.
They tested on mice yet?
It's been tested on animals, yeah. No human data. Mm. And the animal data is preliminary. So this is the kind of thing where you have a nice story. It should be researched. But in medicine, most of these nice stories don't pan out because there are so many other variables that we have to consider. What's the relative toxicity of this to cancer cells versus human cells? What is the dose you have to get to in order to have a significant effect on the cancer? And what are the side effects and toxicities at that dose? You know, will the drug get to the cancer cells in high enough concentration to have a significant effect? It's one thing to do it in a petri dish. It's quite another thing to do it in a living organism with the actual cancer. That's the data that we're missing. So there's actually no conspiracy of silence here. There's no one suppressing DCA. It's in the pipeline. It's going through the usual process of being researched. There's quite a few papers being published on it. It's actually getting a reasonable amount of research attention at the stage that it's at. And we just need to continue the process of doing research and progressing to human trials. It's not without risks. There actually are already case reports of nerve damage, neuropathy occurring with DCA used for other indications in humans, and also encephalopathy. You know, basically, the brain doesn't function well, you know, on the drug. It's not without its risks. It's like any other drug. The whole notion that this is a cure for cancer is way premature. It's just wrong. Most of the drugs at this stage, where there's a really nice story about how it's supposed to kill cancer cells, doesn't end up being a cure for cancer. Of course, nothing so far has turned out to be a cure for cancer because we don't have a cure for cancer. But what happens is either they cause too much toxicity, they just don't work like we thought they did, or they work and they inhibit the growth or spread of some cancers, and they're being used as chemotherapy and with some benefit. Just not an all or instant cure, or something that it will cure all cancers. That's probably what this is destined to be. We'll probably find some cancers that are susceptible to it where it will be adjunctive therapy, where it will become part of the chemotherapy regimen for those cancers, and it will, you know, will make one more baby step towards increasing survival with cancers and, you know what I mean, and decreasing mortality, et cetera. This isn't going to be like a cure for all cancers, and there's no conspiracy. There's plenty of research that's being done on it. But there's an urban legend about DCA. It's going to crop up again. This time it was, you know, somebody posted it on Facebook, and that's all it took. For a while, there were a couple of websites selling DCA directly to consumers. They were shut down because they were selling drugs, you know, over the internet for off-label indications. So, you know, some people try to make this about the powers that be versus, you know, patients who need a cure. But this isn't about need. This is about first doing no harm, going through the steps that are necessary to ensure that we're actually not going to be harming more people than we're helping. I liken this to, I think the analogy I used, which seemed to work, was with situations like this, it's like going bankrupt playing the lottery, right? Just buying lotto tickets, hoping to win big by winning the lottery.
The long shot,
you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. Rather than just spending the same money on sound long-term investments, the payouts maybe will be slower over time, but they're much more higher probability. And in fact, I have no problem with hedging our bets. You know, yeah, buy a couple lottery tickets, make some risky investments, but put the bulk of your money into, you know, investments that you know are going to pay off, and you know, spread it out like, you know, a little bit, like investors recommend. You can make the same analogy to research. You want to research things that we know are probably going to work, but then do some experimental stuff that's more speculative. And some people want to be researching really speculative things at the edges, at the fringes. That's fine. But just because we're not jumping to give a speculative new drug to cancer patients doesn't mean that we don't care about cancer patients or that there's a conspiracy to suppress it. That's just naive nonsense.
Damn Facebook.
Yeah. Well, we're going to be seeing more. I mean, obviously, urban legends existed pre-social media. Social media just has rapidly sped up the cycle and the spreading of it.
So this may never go away. It'll just come around in cycles every couple of years.
It'll be Laetril. You know, let's say it fails. This thing will become the next Laetril, right? Laetril was a drug in the 70s that had promise, looked good in mice, just didn't work. Didn't work in people. We did the research.
Away, really.
Yep. But they use it in Mexico.
And now you can go to Mexico and get Laetril because there's a big alleged conspiracy to keep it from the people. It's BS. It failed.
I got Laetril in Mexico.
Right. So we'll see. I mean, either this will be the next, you know, it will become a nice little addition to our armamentarium.
Yeah.
You know, with
is that a word?
Armamentarium? Absolutely.
I came across that. Cool.
Perfectly cromulent. With side effects, you know, like everything else. Or it'll become the next Laetril. You know, that's where, but we won't know until we do the research. All right. But I hear, Bob, that this is a little bit of a clumsy segue, but the bacteria in your stomach can influence your behavior. I want to know about that.
Well, wait, I'm looking up armamentarium. Yes, that is a word. Very nice.
You doubted me.
No, not
nice,
really.
Steve.
Not really. Well, yeah, this is pretty cool. It's yet another piece of evidence why bacteria are the dominant form of life on Earth. scientists have recently shown that bacteria in our gut, or in rats' guts, can influence not only brain chemistry, but behavior itself. Researchers at McMaster University showed in a very interesting series of experiments that certain behaviors of rats could be linked directly to the strain of bacteria currently residing in their digestive systems. Now, I thought, my first impression was that this is great. Any bad behavior I engage in, I can totally just blame my bacteria. You know, talk about escape bacteria. It's bacteria's fault. But you guys know about, you guys know that we're mostly bacteria, right? If you just like weighed the bacterial cells and the human cells, the bacteria
Bob,
win.
I thought we were ugly bags of mostly water.
Nice
yeah, that's what I was going to say, water.
Right. Essentially, yeah, still are.
If you count cells or weight or genes, there's more bacteria in us than people.
Yep. Yeah.
And that's a good thing.
Our gut alone is the primary domicile for about a quadrillion bacteria. So we're talking huge numbers here. Now, remember that bacteria are a lot like sharks. Sure, there's some really nasty ones out there, but the vast majority are incredibly important. And our bodies, they borrow energy from our diet and protect us against infections. They feed cells in our digestive system. So many good things. It's really quite a symbiotic relationship.
Yeah, but to be clear, most bacteria neither help nor harm us. They just don't care. A few are bad and a few are good. The vast majority are neutral.
Yeah, that's probably a fair representation. But the ones that are good are crazy good.
Oh, like, yeah. We need
nitrogen in the soil. Hello. So the experiments, let me go on about some of these experiments. They kind of did two different experiments that were really interesting. The first one, they gave rats antibiotics. And they checked out their behavior because with these antibiotics, you're killing huge colonies of bacteria all over. So they checked out their behavior, and their behavior changed. They became less cautious. They became more anxious. And they actually detected an increase in brain-derived neurotrophic factor, BDNF, which has been linked to depression and anxiety. So that was fairly compelling right there. But the next experiment really kind of nailed it, you know, in my estimation here. They took these germ-free mice. It's amazing what the different strains of mice that they produce with these various experiments. They have mice that have no germs. There's like no bacteria, I guess, anywhere. So they take these germ-free mice and they colonize them with the bacteria from mice that behave differently. They took these genetically passive mice and they gave them the bacteria from these more daring, more exploratory mice. And they observed their behavior, and lo and behold, these mice that were initially passive became more daring, more exploratory. And they also did it in reverse. They took mice with a genetic history of being more active and gave them the strain this new strain of bacteria from more passive mice, and they became more passive. So it seems to be a direct correlation there. Now, I don't mean to say that that we'll soon simply just change our bacteria and tailor our own behavior, although that's kind of interesting to contemplate. What we may soon see, though, is a way to get a handle on certain behavioral disorders that may ultimately be greatly influenced by our bacteria that we have within us. For example, there's certain gastrointestinal diseases, which include irritable bowel syndrome, which is fairly common, that are often associated with depression or anxiety. And there's also been some hypotheses put forward that some psychiatric disorders, Steve, have you heard of this, like late onset autism, may be associated with abnormal bacterial content in the gut.
Yeah, I think that's speculative.
That's why I said it was a hypothesis. But there's still people are kind of leaning in that direction. So the better we understand how our bacteria affect brain chemistry, the sooner we may be able to get a handle on some of the behavioral disorders that may be causing problems. And perhaps we could even one day potentially tweak our own behavior in certain beneficial ways.
It sounds counterintuitive when you think about it. It makes perfect sense in that, there are hormones that are released from our intestinal system, our GI system, that affects our brain, specifically with regard to hunger and satiety. So it makes sense that bacteria would, hijack this hormonal signaling system that's already there and could affect behavior, through that mechanism.
Yes.
So it actually makes perfect sense that would be the case.
Do you guys find it kind of creepy what bacteria do?
No, they're awesome, man. Don't you call them creepy.
Gotta accept that. You have mites eating on your eyelashes. That's a little creepy.
Yeah, that's a lot more creepy than bacteria.
But we're coated with bacteria. It's got to get used to it.
So, Jay, just don't think about it, dude.
Howard got used to it. Look what happened to him.
Evan, give us a quick update on the search for habitable planets around other suns.
A topic we've talked about before on the show. It comes up regularly because it's in the news regularly. So about 20 light years away from us, there is a star.
Close.
A red dwarf star in a system called Gliese 581.
Oh, yeah, we've talked about that.
Yes, and one of the planets that's orbiting Gliese 581, specifically Gliese 581d, is a new candidate for as being a habitable exoplanet. In fact, it was originally thought when the planet was first discovered that it could be, because it did. We did discover it in the range of the Goldilocks zone, which means not too hot, not too cold.
Just right. By the way, in German, it's Gliese.
Gliese.
Yeah.
Oh, so I put too much emphasis on the
not
Gliese. Syllable.
We're talking English.
Gliese.
Yeah, just saying.
Gliese. It is a German word.
Gliese.
It was deemed, though, after some more research was done, that it was probably not a habitable planet because it was too close to the edge of the Goldilocks zone on the outer on the far side, and that it only got 30% of the sun's radiation that we get here on the Earth. So by comparison, it probably is going to just be too cold. So it was dismissed after that research was done. However, some new research has been done by scientists at the Institut Pierre-Simon Laplace in Paris, and they've confirmed that Gliese 581d is back in the mix as being a habitable exoplanet, and that it could support Earth-like life. And the reason is because they have a new computer model with the capacity to simulate extraterrestrial climates. Which is something we didn't have initially when we started discovering these exoplanets, 5, 6, 7 years ago. So they've come up with a new way to determine if planets like this one and others, based on the environment of the planet, even though it is on the fringes of the Goldilocks zone, still might be able to compensate enough greenhouse gases and so forth to allow creatures like us to one day inhabit it.
Evan, do they know what the gravity would be like?
Well, we know that it has a mass that's about 5.5 times that of Earth.
And again, the mass and gravity is not necessarily a linear thing because as you
the
surface, you get a larger radius, so you're farther away from the center of mass. So I think it was about twice the surface gravity of Earth.
Right, okay.
Is what they're currently calculating. A lot of this is still, you know, speculative, and there are still those astronomers who think that Gliese 581G may not even exist. So
right.
This is far from settled, you know, what the properties and even existence of this planet are.
Funny, we're simulating the atmosphere on a planet that might not even exist.
Right.
But it's nice. We have kind of this new vector now. If there is this new new simulation that they are able to come up with, assuming it's accurate and
yeah.
they're able to test it out at other places, it does kind of expand that, you know, narrow band, that narrow, otherwise narrow band
yeah, but that,
of what is possible.
That makes sense. I mean, now we can simulate it and bring a little bit more rigor to it, but we knew even just from the examples in our own solar system that the Goldilocks zone is not just about the light output of the star, but also about the atmosphere. You know, the more greenhouse gases you have, the hotter it's going to be, even with less light, and the less you have, you know, the colder it's going to be, even with more light. So,
but Steve, I have another beef with the Goldilocks zone, because look at the moons of Jupiter. You can have life on the moons of Jupiter totally because of the tidal forces acting on that moon, causing friction and the changing of the shape. Well, you've got heat, you've got water, you've got a liquid environment, you've got minerals. I mean, you could potentially produce life, and this is so far from the sun, it's actually irrelevant. It's all about the tidal forces and what elements
right.
are available. So, you know, that concept of the Goldilocks zone is kind of narrow if you define it
is.
In terms of distance.
Although to defend it a little bit, they were talking about the Goldilocks zone for an Earth-like planet. So not like
okay. right. That's
not
fine.
Not Europa, you know, where we're talking about the oceans under an ice moon of a Jovian planet, but liquid water on the surface with an atmosphere similar to our atmosphere, you know, a planet that we can go to and walk around on the surface.
Yeah, didn't
absolutely.
Seth describe it as a swampy or soupy planet?
Yeah, they're wet. Yeah, Bob, there's a quick follow up on the alleged possible sighting of the Higgs boson at the LHC.
Yeah, this is really quick. This came out a while ago. I don't know, was that a month or so ago? Some internal memo was leaked on the web, and that they possibly found a signal from the Higgs boson. And there's a big storm of information, you know, news items about it. Everybody was speculating, and it was really just something that was uncovered by the ATLAS experiment at LHC, and it was just totally preliminary. It wasn't vetted to any significant degree at all. I was just like, guys, this is just, you know, we're doing the science here, and this wasn't fit for, you know, for public consumption. It wasn't totally premature, and that's pretty much the bottom line. So the new little bit here is that they've done cross-checks of the data in question that was collected by the ATLAS experiment, and they have found no signal. So there is no signal. It kind of went away when they really took a really close look at it, which kind of made sense because it was so preliminary and things like that happen all the time. And there was also the added little thing that there was the effect was 30 times greater than the standard model would predict, which would have been interesting because it meant new physics, but it also kind of increased the odds a bit that it was kind
fake.
Of this little spurious signal. And but it's so there's nothing there and just got to wait a little more to find the Higgs. Cross your fingers.
The LHC did put out a statement. They said at a press release, never mind.
Yeah.
Now, we're
they
sure
were bummed. They
Higgs.
Were pissed. they were pissed that it got out. The
we're sure there's a Higgs field? I mean, we can confirm that?
No, that's what they're trying. They're trying to confirm it. It's pretty much the last brick in the standard, you know, the standard model of
it's
physics.
It's pretty solid theory, and this would be the first experimental verification.
Yeah, is there I'd a competing theory right now to it? Or
to the standard model? No. I mean,
no.
I mean, extensions, you know, extending the standard model, but the standard model is one of the most successful, how would you refer to it, Steve? Meta-theories? I mean, it's just, it's really the foundation of physics.
Particle physics, yeah.
It's just an amazing, its predictive power. It's really nailed it.
It's like the periodic table for elements. This is the standard model for particles. You know, it predicts there should be a particle here with these properties.
Right.
Oh, look at that. There is. You know, it confirms.
Right.
It.
So and even if there probably will be, and I think they're going to nail it probably within a couple of years. But even if there isn't, even if they don't find it within the energy range that they're looking, it would still tell us some interesting things and point us in new directions. So it's like a win-win. And just wait for the good science to be done, and you won't be disappointed.
Well, Evan, it's time for Who's That Noisy?
All right. So for those of you who forgot last week's Who's That Noisy, I happen to have it handy, and I'm going to play it for you again right now. All right.
Now, I don't think there's any way you could possibly infer what that sound was just from the way it sounds. You essentially have to know it.
It does sound like kind of a scratching on a paper or an old quill, right, on a parchment, that kind of
two
scratching
hard
noise.
Things rubbing up against each other.
It's very suggested.
A lot of guesses came in, and several of them actually were right.
Really?
That is a jumping spider conducting its mating ritual.
Whoa.
An audible sound that the spider makes when it's getting ready to get down.
Yeah.
Wow.
That's
weird.
Fascinating.
Spider's
little
cool.
Teeny jumping spider.
Very nice.
So it's amazing.
Who got it right?
RC Cola from the forums. Well done.
Really? RC Cola?
RC Cola. I don't know their real name, but good enough. Royal Crown Cola. My dad used to drink that by the gallon. It was his favorite drink until he developed diabetes, and then he kind of had to. This is great. Oh, it's killing me.
It's killing me.
Okay, what do you got for this week, Ed?
Here we go. This week's Who's That Noisy?
What the hell was that?
That's what I said. That's what Krusty wants to know, too. I think that's
Holy
what we all want to
crap.
Know. What the hell was that?
Okay.
Go ahead and give it your best guess, everyone. Send us an email. Write us a note. Hit us up on Facebook.
Thanks, Evan. Well, this week we are going to introduce a new segment. This is going to be one of those segments that we'll do probably not every single week. It'll be like the Name That Logical Fallacy. We'll do it as often as we can. But Jay, you're going to head up this segment. We had a bit of a discussion as to what to call it.
Well, what we did was we asked people on our message board to submit ideas for the new segment. I described the new segment, what the topic was, and we got tons of people writing in. It was a lot of fun. There was about four or five of them that I really liked. But we did pick one, and we pretty much voted on it tonight. And the new segment is called Swindler's List. This segment is going to be about scams, schemes, and the people who run them. It's going to cover some of the more popular scams that are going on today. I'm going to focus a lot on internet scams. I'm also going to try to find people that used to be involved in scams and interview them. So we'll see how well that goes. But, you know, it is a topic that I'm very interested in. It's a lot of fun. Everyone can find something about a scam that they can relate to because most people have been scammed. And hopefully I'll be able along the way to teach people some things to look out for. Well, I'll start by asking you guys, what is a scam? Let's define it.
A scam is someone or some people who intentionally deceive others at the in order to get a profit.
Yeah, I think that's a good. Yeah, there's some deliberate deception in order to get something out of something else, somebody else.
Right.
A scam is the activity. The people who do it are called lots of different things: hucksters and cheats. They're also called confidence men, and it's
or
a confidence game. Actually, yeah, they're con men, and that's where the word con comes from. I want to focus on scams that we commonly find on the internet, that we get emailed, things like that that we all encounter in our day-to-day lives that you might not even realize are scams. And I'll give you a really good example of one. We picked a scam to go over tonight that's very easy to understand. It's very clear to see. It's a very obvious scam, but a lot of people are being taken in on this. And this is something that Steve found. It's a website called BidSell.com.
Now, actually, you know, yes, I think when I started to look into it, it became clear to me that there was something fishy. But to be clear, when I got the, I don't know if it was an email or however I first encountered it, it definitely got my attention. And I investigated it hoping that the claims were real. And they were just plausible enough to hook me in.
Uh-oh, bait. I smell a bait and switch.
It was absolutely a bait and switch. So what I encountered first was the claim that iPads were being sold for something like $47. So
I've seen that.
Yeah, my first thought was, wow, $47, that's cheap. I wonder if they're like only the iPad 1s, and they're trying to get rid of them because iPad 2 just came out, and maybe they're, you know, they're the low end ones like the 16 gigabyte or whatever. But I was, but it hooked me because my you know, my daughter wants an iPad, and I thought, yeah, for $37, you know, what can you lose, you know?
And they're selling iPhones, the old iPhones now, for like $45. So I don't think it's totally unreasonable to think that it might be legitimate at that point.
Yeah, but of course you needed an investigation. So
yeah, that's still a little too cheap for me for just the first gen, just one gen away from the latest.
Well, here's how it works. The first thing, when you go to the site, they pull you in by showing you a bunch of different products that are going for an incredibly discounted rate. Like, as an example, there's a $100 American Express card. It's like one of those cards that you could buy in the supermarket where you could just throw down $100 and you get the credit card. Right now, as it's showing it on the website, there's 18 seconds left, and it's going for $2.91.
Woohoo!
I've seen iPads sold on this site claiming that they were going for $20 or $30. So I signed up. I asked for their privacy policy. I read through their privacy policy. It was pretty boilerplate. There were a few things in the privacy policy I didn't like. But mainly the overall idea of the site is this. You can't see any of the details of any of the items that are being auctioned there until you buy their site's dollars, which they call bids. So let's say that you spend a couple of $100, you buy 400 bids, and then you use bids as your money to make purchases. So this is what actually takes place on the site. Every once in a while, they let a product go through, and then they get an enormous amount of feedback from that person saying this was great and everything, and they play up those sales. But what they're actually doing is they're waiting for you to bid. They're seeing if there's real people that are bidding, and I'll get to that in a second. If real people are actually bidding, what they allow to take place is that they extend the time of the bid. Let's say there's 20 seconds left and you say, okay, I'm going to throw $10 down on this, more than what I've already bid. Then what happens is they'll add a few seconds and then they'll get one of their bots to come in and make a bid 2 cents above your bid or 50 cents above your bid. So they're using software, they're using bots to inspire people to continue the bid process. And what they want to do is get you over that dollar amount, which is above their cost for the product. And as a matter of fact, I actually think that what they do is they place an order at the manufacturer and send you the product from the manufacturer.
Yeah, so they're presenting themselves as a replacement for eBay, a place where you bid and sell stuff, just like eBay. But the difference is that it costs you to make a bid. So it seems to me they're just trying to suck people in with these ridiculously low sale prices to pay money to make bids on these objects. But then it's not like really an open, transparent bid where you're just bidding against other people. Even if there's no deception involved, it could be that the business model is that the reason that you can buy a $100 gift certificate for $2 is because they're getting more than $100 worth of paid bids. Yeah. So it's almost like playing the lottery at that point, right? You're bidding to buy something at a really cheap rate, but you're going to spend a lot of money bidding and only winning a very few things. So it's possible that that's all that's going on. They're just not being really honest up front about that. They're sort of doing the bait and switch. But Jay, you're saying that in addition, they may be gaming the bid even beyond the fact that you're just paying for the privilege of bidding by having their bots delay it or like prevent real people from winning or jacking up the ultimate bid when there are real people involved.
I read a lot of online forums about this, and there was tons and tons of people all saying it's a scam, don't do it. And what happens is they say that they get down to the final seconds of the bid, and then all of a sudden there is either one or a flurry of bids that come in from people that they've never seen bidding on the site before or whatever, and everyone is coming to the same conclusion. It just seems like it's all happening, that it's predictably happening. If you bid on something a minute before the auction goes, a bid will come in right after that. If you do it 2 seconds before, a bid will come in right after that. So from looking at the site, I couldn't see anywhere that I can actually put products up here. I'm pretty sure that this site only allows you to buy product that they put up,
that the company is brokering in some way, yeah.
Right. There isn't p- people on here that actually host auctions. They're just bidders.
All right. Well, thanks, Jay. We'll look forward to more installments of Swindler's List. Well, let's go on with our interview. We are joined now by James Randi. Randi, welcome back to the Skeptic's Guide.
It's good to be here. It's been quite a while. Of course, I've had a few intervening adventures, as you probably know.
Yes, you're doing quite a bit of traveling. Tell us about your recent exploits.
Well, exploits. I don't know whether we put it that way, but I'll go along with that. I got out to Norway. I hadn't been in Norway for many years. Frankly, guys, I was totally astonished at the amount of media I got in Norway. Of course, they have a pretty crazy princess there, as you guys may know. She is selling all kinds of methods of getting a hold of your guardian angels. And the Norwegians in general are sort of embarrassed by the royal family. But we didn't get into all of that. Then just recently, just 2 days ago, as a matter of fact, I came back from Spain. We went to one of the offshore islands there where they have an old penal colony. I wasn't going there for that purpose. I guess you'll be glad to know. But a beautiful, beautiful island. I was there with the DJ, or the president of the JRF, as you know. And we had a wonderful time and accomplished a great deal. It was a neuroscience and magic combination where these neuroscientists are tapping the brains of magicians. They're very small and hard to find, but they're in there someplace. We were able to give them a lot of clues for the last few years. As a matter of fact, we've been able to give the neuroscientists a lot of clues on how the mind works from our point of view. And it's quite a collaboration. I think it's going to develop some very interesting information, but it has a great future, I believe.
Yeah, so that's very interesting. You're lending them your expertise in, I'm assuming, perception and deception, those kind of things, and they're looking to see what the brain activity correlates are. Are they looking at the brains of magicians while they're doing tricks, or the people that magicians are doing tricks to?
As I said, those brains are very hard to find. They're rich in little shrunken things way in the middle of the bony mass on the head. But they're looking at the reactions that people have, and that they've got. I found this most exciting. The part of the conference was devoted to people who are selling machinery for tracking eye motions. Now, you can't imagine how fascinating this is to magicians, of course. And I have volunteered to supply some videos so that they can put videos up and then track the eyeball movements of the subjects that they're studying. And they will be able to tell where the attention has been diverted. The methods for doing this, taking reflections off the eyeballs of infrared light and such, are really wonderful. And they're so accurate. They can register the path of the person's eyeballs on the video itself. And you can see this dot jumping around back and forth, and you can time exactly how many microseconds it stayed at any one particular portion of the video. And we magicians are going to learn a great deal about how well and how badly we do our tricks, I think.
That's also a great way for people to interface with a computer. If you're, say, a quadriplegic, or even if you're locked in and you just have just only your eyes can move, you could actually use a computer in some limited way to interact with it, and the computer will know where you're looking, so you could actually select letters to print out and things like that. It's a pretty interesting technology.
Now, getting back to the neuroscience thing, has there been, did they describe to you any conclusions that they've made so far from this line of research?
I'm ashamed to tell you, I don't recall I am not at my office at the moment, I'm at home.
Okay.
I don't recall the name of the book that Stephen and Susanna have turned out. They have come up with wonderful relationships between the conjuring art, as I prefer to call it, and how the brain works, and how we are able to mislead the brain. And I, as I pointed out, and several magicians have, we had Max Maven, a wonderful magicians with us. They're very, very accomplished, talented folks who gave us the their input. We've known for a long time that a lot of magicians don't really know why their tricks work. All they do is they try them in various ways, and they find that they do work. And in many cases, they don't know just how subtle they are being. And for example, years ago, when videotape machines first became available, this may be far before your time, Steve, but reel-to-reel Sony recorders, a half-inch tape that went from reel-to-reel, very much like an audio tape recorder, but they were big, monstrous, heavy consoles. And some people at Sony managed to get one to me. And I was one of the only people that I knew of who could actually record television programs and record myself with a small black and white, in those days, camera. I was one of the first people to have this sort of thing, and certainly one of the first magicians. And what I did was a rather bizarre thing, but not for a magician, I guess. I actually set the video recorder at the back of an auditorium where I was doing shows every night and aiming up at the stage. And that included the heads of a lot of people in the foreground of the audience, you see. And I was amazed when I watched the videotape after the first videotape I made. I was amazed to find I was doing things on stage of which I was quite unconscious. That's all part of this picture, of course. There were little Jackie Gleason moves and such with the arms and the feet that I was doing as I moved from spot to spot on the stage. And it always got a bit of a titter from the audience, something that I was not aware of previously, because I'm not listening for those things when I'm on stage. I'm completely dedicated to the art of deception while I'm up there. And to find that I was doing these things unconsciously and the audience was reacting to them, and also noting the backs of heads, you can see a pair of heads turn to one another as if to whisper something, you know, oh, did you see that kind of thing? And I became very conscious of that. So the next night, when I went on stage in the same venue, I almost froze up. I was thinking to myself, oh, here's the spot where I do the funny little thing with the hand. And I did it all right, I guess, but I was so conscious of it that I almost became catatonic on stage. So it's interesting how you react to knowing more about yourself and your performance than you really should know.
Yeah, because we do so much that's subconscious. Yeah. And when you're made, you could easily be made, as you say, self-conscious about it.
Yeah.
Like the other night, somebody commented that I blink slowly. And okay, so now I'm thinking about blinking. How quickly am I blinking now? You know, then you can't not think about blinking.
And that's why the subconscious is so powerful, because, I mean, it kind of becomes subsumed within the subconscious, and that makes it more efficient and more fast, right, Steve? Isn't that kind of what happens? It just kind of becomes instinctive.
Well, it's also inattentional blindness. You can't pay attention to everything. There's so much right. sensory output, both from the outside world and from your own body. Of course you have to ignore 99% of it, because otherwise you'd be distracted by every little thing.
Hey, Randy, I think I've got that book name here. Is it Sleights of Mind?
Yes.
Sleights of Mind, What the Neuroscience of Magic Reveals About Our Everyday Deceptions.
Exactly. That is exactly the book. Thank you.
So, and Randy, we have mentioned before that your current project that you're working on while you're not zipping around the world is finishing your current book, which is A Magician in the Laboratory.
That is correct, and it's coming along quite well, Steve. The problem is too much information now, because I've been saving files that I would just title book and then 1, 2, 3, 4, you know, label them that way. I have about 200 files at the moment that I'm going through, and I'm starting getting them organized into chapters as I go along. It is difficult. There's just so much information available. I've got to make very sure that I'm not repeating myself or repeating the idea or the concept. And it's difficult. It's difficult to get it sorted out. It's a case of a richness of information that maybe I don't deserve or want.
Since you've been going over it, are there any particularly juicy stories that you're working on in the book that you'd like to share with us?
The most recent thing is the Osama bin Laden death, of course. One lady who watches my page all the time, she sent me an email that has 9 instances of where Sylvia Browne said that Osama bin Laden would be captured and brought to the United States in handcuffs, of course, and chains and various things. And then she would always say, oh, yes, surely, within the next, I see it during the next 90 days, Montel, or whoever she was speaking to at the moment. And when the time came that he was actually shot and killed, there was nothing, not a sound from Sylvia. Isn't that strange?
Hmm. So she was just hoping to get lucky and then hoping that people would forget the other 8 times she predicted
Osama. Course. And people do that. They do that. You guys know that. They will forget all of the well, it's like any kind of evidence like that in the mentalism business or in the fake psychic business, as they say. They depend on you forgetting places where they were wrong. And Sylvia has been so wrong, profoundly wrong in so many cases, and made these very firm declarations. Oh, yes, this, that, the other thing. And they forget altogether. Of course, Montel Williams he's what we call in the business a media whore. He will take anything on as long as it's sensational and as long as it attracts attention and it brings him sponsors. Now, I have a recording, which I'd be happy to send to you if you like, an audio recording of Montel Williams on a radio show, some obscure radio show, in which he is asked specifically, Montel, do you believe in psychics? And he says, no, of course not, particularly not Sylvia Browne. They say, yes, but you have her on your program all the time. Yes, I do, because she brings me sponsors. Now, that's the answer of somebody who is, I think, very, very irresponsible. And I find the media in general to be irresponsible in this respect. I know that editors and producers and such are sitting there waiting for the next psychic to walk through the door so they can grab him or her and believe everything that they say.
Well, Randy, we have to talk about the upcoming, the amazing meeting, TAM-9 from Outer Space. Love the title.
Yeah.
How are things going with TAM so far?
The expression is swimmingly, to say the least. DJ Grothy, our president, is rather concerned with the fact that he's got hardly any spaces left at it, and it's weeks away from existence, of course. We're talking about the Las Vegas one now.
Yeah.
And as you know, last year we held 3 of them in Las Vegas and in the UK and in Australia as well. All of them very, very highly successful. This year with TAM Las Vegas, the seats, so to speak, are going very, very quickly. I actually had to get my word in at the last minute. I've got a couple of close friends that I want to get registrations for. And they said, well, I don't know. We'll have to look around. And I'm supposed to be the head honcho, you see.
Yeah.
I would think that I might have a little bit of authority someplace here to squeeze somebody in, but they say, I don't know whether we can or not. There are some spaces left, I'm told, but boy, they're very few. And we broke all records last year. We filled that casino to the roof.
So is there a risk that TAM will sell out?
Yes, there is distinctly a risk of that. And
Number would that be?
To turn people away. And to me, it's my despair, really. I want people to be able to be there. But casinos are only so big. I think the next thing is we'll have to build our own casino before next year.
Mm-hmm. And this year, there is a tremendous lineup. We're really looking forward to it ourselves. We have Neil deGrasse Tyson coming back.
Neil deGrasse Tyson, he's a character and a half. I love the guy. He's really, you saw it. He's very, very personable. He goes across with the audience beautifully, and it's not only because they see him on television a lot, it's because he's a genuinely interesting, endearing person, and he really captivates that audience. And we have Richard Dawkins back again, as a matter of fact. He is, to say the least, I will say it here, I've said it before, and I'll say it here again, he's almost a god to me, almost. I just said
demigod.
Okay, demigod will do. Thank you very much. But that is true. I've never heard, first of all, I've never heard an angry word out of his mouth. He's an Oxford Don, after all, and they're not allowed to have angry words, I believe. I've heard a lot of frustration from him because he's trying to get his point across, but he gets his point across. He's a wonderful speaker and writer, and my hat's off to him. I'll tell you, I admire the man greatly. He.
All right, Randy, thank you so much for joining us again.
Okay, guys, thank you for your participation. We have to do this more often, okay?
Absolutely. Well, we'll definitely chat when we're physically together.
Okay, very good.
All right, good night, Randy.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fake. Then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. You guys ready for this week?
Mm-hmm.
All right. Yes.
Tally-ho.
Some interesting items this week. Item number one. Imaging studies of ancient Egyptian mummies find an almost complete absence of atherosclerosis, hardening of the arteries, even in the older individuals. Item number two, astronomers have detected a new class of planet, Jupiter-sized rogue planets wandering interstellar space, and estimate their number at 400 billion in the Milky Way. Item number three, researchers find that exposure to cockroach antigen is a significant contributor to childhood asthma. Jay, go first.
All right. Okay, so the one about the ancient Egyptians not getting atherosclerosis or hardening of the arteries, that's interesting. And I think that's absolutely possible, being that they could have had a particular diet. And I'm sure that certain types of eating habits can cause hardening of the arteries. And also, I'm sure it's genetic, right? Genetically, they could have had a predisposition to not have that happen to them. So that, I can definitely believe that one. The one about astronomers detected a new class of planet, this is really cool, a Jupiter-sized rogue planet wandering into stellar space. Wow, I really like how that sounds.
That sounds like the Death Star flying around.
Yeah, it does. It's there's something kind of scary about it in a way, too. And Steve's saying here that there's 400 billion of them in the Milky Way. I'd say sure on that one as well. Researchers find that the exposure to a cockroach antigen is a significant contributor to childhood asthma. Wow, I could totally buy that one too. Steve, good job this week. Well, okay. I'd say that the one about the cockroaches is fake, just because, you know, there'd have to be a lot of cockroaches giving off the antigen. And I'm guessing at this, of course. I'm just, you know, throwing some ideas together here. Unless someone's living in a totally infested house, I don't know if there'd be that much of the antigen floating around for it to actually contribute to asthma. So I'm going to say that one's the fake.
Okay, Bob.
The Jupiter-sized rogues, yeah, I can see that. I mean, I could see lots of scenarios where planets could get ejected from solar systems. 400 billion sounds like a lot, but, yeah, that does sound like a lot. And that's just Jupiter-sized. I mean, I wonder how many Earth-sized planets there would be. I don't have that much of a problem with that one. First and third, though, these, I'm not sure what to think of these guys. The Egyptian mummies and the almost complete absence of atherosclerosis is interesting. It doesn't sound quite right to me, though. I would think that even you know, some people just have genetic predispositions for that. No matter what you do, I would think they would find it. Then again, how many samples? You know, how many did they actually study? You know, was it really a representative sample? Can you extrapolate from, you know, the mummies that they examined to the general community? Back then, I'm not sure. And the cockroach antigen, man, I've never seen a cockroach in any place I've ever lived. Doesn't mean they're not there.
Yeah.
Man, I lived in Baltimore. We had massive cockroaches down there.
So, yeah, for me, it's a choice between the mummy and the cockroach antigen. Trying to see, my first impression of the imaging studies of the mummies is that it would be too hard. Be too hard to really draw any solid conclusions from. I mean, you can just imagine the what would be left of the arteries. I might need to fall back on that. Then I just think after so much time, so much desiccation, that even the imaging would be very difficult to infer the level of atherosclerosis in the mummy. So I'm gonna go with that and say that the mummy is fake because of that.
Okay, Evan?
May I ask, Steve, what is the most common method or what's the most common cause of hardening of the arteries? Are you allowed to answer that?
But at this point, I mean, I didn't answer any questions for Bob or Jay, so I would...
I know, but they didn't ask.
Yeah. I don't know how to answer that without influencing your response.
That one's science. And then the Jupiter-sized rogue planets. Now, okay, so if something is ejected, Bob, as you say, from a solar system, is it technically a planet anymore? I don't know that that's something to read into in to whether this is science or fiction, but I think it's an interesting question. 400 billion in the Milky Way. There's, what, 100 billion stars, eight to nine planets per 400 billion? That seems like a lot of planets that got ejected. I don't know about that one. Now, the cockroach antigen. Jay, I was thinking that this one was fiction as well. An antigen is something that produces immune response in the body? So the cockroach, so when this happens in the cockroach body...
I guess that means there's pieces of cockroaches in the environment triggering asthma.
Well, boy, that seems like a lot of cockroach pieces, but I'm tending to think that that one is science as well. So it's, I'm going to say that the Jupiter-sized rogue planets one is fiction because I think...
Okay, so you guys are all over the place.
Yeah.
You can't lose.
Steve can't lose.
I guess I'll take them in order since you guys are all spread out. Imaging studies of ancient Egyptian mummies find an almost complete absence of atherosclerosis, hardening of the arteries, even in the older individuals. Bob, you think this one is the fiction. Evan and Jay think this one is science. And this one is...
is.
The fiction.
Yeah, baby. Oh, yeah, man. Baby.
Good job, Bob. Yeah, this is fiction. But not for the reason that you said...
I don't care.
They were able to image the arteries in many of these mummies, but they found the opposite. They found that they had significant atherosclerosis, and that was a surprise. Now, you might be wondering how they were able to image the arteries in several thousand-year-old desiccated mummies. It's because the atherosclerosis leaves behind calcifications, little calcium deposits, and that shows up quite nicely on a CAT scan. Yeah, so
I don't care.
In fact, some of the mummies they investigated still had their hearts. Now, usually they remove the hearts, you know, they put them in those jars, but some of them still had their hearts, and they diagnosed an Egyptian princess who was the first person or the oldest individual because of this diagnosed with coronary artery disease. Because they were able to see her coronary arteries, which had a shockingly high level of atherosclerosis, of calcifications. This is surprising, they said, because they had a great diet, you know, not a lot of fat. They were physically very active. Mm. Although, Evan, you're right. You do wonder, you know, was the nobility maybe more pampered? Maybe they, it wasn't quite so great. Or again, it could just be genetics.
Yeah, I would. You know, they just. I would think that maybe some. You know, familial strain of...
Yeah, of, running through the royal family there. So
the descendants of these people would have the same condition?
Well, again, it depends on to what extent was this lifestyle versus genetics or some combination, or is there some other factor? But they had no exposure to tobacco or trans fats, right? So
trans fats.
Atherosclerosis has been considered... a disease of modern civilization. So it's interesting to see that, no, it's actually not isolated to modern civilization, even a largely agrarian, you know, pre-industrial community. You know, there was still atherosclerosis. It's interesting. All right, let's go on to number two. Astronomers have detected a new class of planet, Jupiter-sized rogue planets wandering interstellar space, and estimate their number at 400 billion in the Milky Way. This is very cool science. Yeah. This is my favorite story. I almost decided just to talk about it as a news item, but it was just too good to use as science or fiction. And 400 billion is a lot. That's more than the number of main sequence stars in the Milky Way galaxy.
Yeah.
What the astronomers did, they suspected that there probably were these rogue planets floating out there because occasionally planets will get ejected from their solar system. What they did was they used micro-lensing observations.
Ooh, cool.
Yep, and optical gravitational lensing experiments. And they combined this data to look for large planets in interstellar space, and they found them. They can only find the larger ones, the Jovian-sized ones. And they did a count and then extrapolated, so assumption, and they sort of did the best they could to extrapolate and... given the number that they found and the space that they found it, they estimated that there may be as many as 400 billion of these Jovian planets roving around out there.
I wonder how they knew where to look.
They just looked where they could. They figured they're everywhere. If they were in the one place that they were looking, that's one of the assumptions they made. Well, if they're there, they're probably everywhere in the galaxy and probably at the same density, and that calculates out to 400 billion.
So these rogues are still considered planets?
Well, as the item says, Evan, it's a new class of planet. It's a rogue planet. It's a new class. But yeah, it's a planet. What else are you going to call it?
Well, by definition, doesn't a planet have to be in?
Well, that's why it's a new class.
Around a star.
Probably was at some point, but then was ejected from the system, and now it's a rogue planet.
The non-rogue planets would have to be around a star, but
yeah.
Not the rogue ones.
So they named a class of planet after you guys, after the rogues.
Hey, I like that. 400 billion
awesome.
Of them.
But imagine how many smaller planets there are out there, how many Earth-sized or roughly Earth-sized planets. There could be
dozens.
Could be trillions of planets bouncing around the Milky Way in between the stars. Can you imagine?
Wait, could that be dark matter?
Multiball and breakout out there, you know, crazy stuff. Smash. Wouldn't they see, well, I guess there's enough space that you wouldn't see collisions of these planets getting hurled into each other. That would
No way. That's
so
like
rare.
That's like two mosquitoes hitting each other in the Grand Canyon.
Yeah, that's the typical analogy that's given. But there's also some speculation.
I've never heard it before.
You're right. The gnats is what I usually hear, not mosquitoes.
I had to change it up a little bit.
Some of these planets, they say, may still be able to harbor life.
Whoa.
And so that sounds like really? Wow, how could that be? But it's funny, we're just having this conversation.
Bacteria.
With Gliese. So depending on the atmosphere, they could retain a lot of heat. And if they're generating heat within them and the atmosphere is retaining that heat, trapping it, they could, in fact, have a high enough temperature on the planetary surface in order to support life.
Well, that's pretty...
Completely geothermal rather than solar, you know, life, but that's...
All right, so you would need some sort of... you need a runaway greenhouse, you were saying, to...
Yes, pretty much.
That's interesting. I mean, what kind of geothermal energy would this planet have to be producing to sustain an atmosphere? Wow, I'd like to run that scenario through a computer and see how feasible that is.
That would be cool. Imagine a civilization evolving on a planet that's a rogue planet with no star.
You wouldn't be able to see anything. Oh, except any light that's generated from the planet itself. It would have to be an internal source.
It's kind of a mind blower. I've never really thought about that, about how... I mean, yeah, I mean... There were planets floating around out there, but it's interesting to think about mechanism by which it could have enough heat to sustain life. Also, what does this do for the possibility of capturing rogue planets? And how often does that happen? There's this many of those planets are out there. How often does it happen that a solar system captures a rogue planet or just has one of these rogue planets moving through?
That was Thundar the Barbarian. That was the premise of that stupid car.
Stupid?
Yeah.
Stupid.
You're right. You're right, Bob. That wasn't a stupid cartoon.
You're going to have a Thundar the Barbarian argument there?
What the hell is a mock, anyways? Some Wookiee thing. Right? So this rogue planet, and they say a runaway planet hurtles between the Earth and the moon, causing destruction.
Yeah, Evan, they show the moon broken in half.
Yeah, that's right. Like someone took a donut or something and ripped it.
That's a cool shot.
Yeah, like it wouldn't just gravity wouldn't just pull it back together.
Nope. So the third one, researchers find that exposure to cockroach antigen is a significant contributor to childhood asthma. That one, of course, is also science. What they did was there are different asthma rates in different parts of the country, different cities, and also just different neighborhoods. So what they did was they went to New York City. They wanted to look at one city so that a lot of the environmental factors like region of the country and climate, everything would be controlled for. And then look at different neighborhoods. And they found that in neighborhoods where there was a high level of asthma, that there was a correlation with high amounts of cockroach, mouse, and cat allergens found, like when they looked at the bed sheets, you know, but that the level of cockroach antigen correlated with the asthma, in addition to the kids who had asthma actually having antibodies to those antigens. So that the story was a little bit better for the cockroach antigens because they also correlated with the antibodies. They also said it makes more of a difference whether what neighborhood you're in rather than even what house you're
in.
So, for example, if you're in a neighborhood with a lot of cockroaches, even though your house may be relatively clear of cockroaches, you still carried the risk of the neighborhood, probably because, you know, cockroaches are getting around, even if you're trying to be clean.
Lovey, I knew we should have moved out of this place.
Exactly. All right, well, good job, Bob.
Nice job, Bob. Well done.
Jay, you have a quote for us this week?
I do. I have a quote from Stephen Hawking, who I freaking love. I think the guy is crazy cool. Somebody made Stephen Hawking out of Legos, and it's one of the funniest freaking things I've ever seen. But anyway, Stephen Hawking recently said, which I'm sure most of you have heard about by now, "I regard the brain as a computer which will stop working when its components fail. There is no heaven or afterlife for broken down computers. That is a fairy story for people afraid of the dark." Stephen Hawking!
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah, pretty out there. I actually blogged about this today. The whole interview that is pulled from is actually very interesting, and it gives it more context. You know, Hawking is talking about the scientific paradigm, what science has to say about these things, and he's being very unapologetically, you know, promoting a scientific worldview.
So damn him!
If you look at that, if in isolation, it looks like a gratuitous swipe against, you know, people of faith, but really it's just saying that, you know, hey, I've been facing death my whole life. The prospect of death is no stranger to me. This is what I think. I take a scientific approach, you know, and this is what I think is the case, right? Perfectly legitimate.
Absolutely.
Also, somebody criticized him, you know, another physicist, and I tear him up on my blog if you want to read about it, because it's a good segment of Name That Logical Fallacy. Well, thanks for that quote, Jay.
My pleasure.
A couple of quick announcements. Just to say that the SGU has an active Twitter feed, a Twitter account. We do tweet all of our blog posts, technical data about when the show goes up. If there's any problems, it's a good way to get information out there. And we've recently started tweeting more on a regular basis, just our thoughts and news items and interesting things. So follow us on Twitter at Skeptics Guide. And if you haven't looked in a while, you can read our blogs, The Rogues Gallery, Neurologica, and Science-Based Medicine. And you can check us out on Facebook as well. We have an active fan page.
Yeah, don't join the group page because we're ending that. We're basically asking everyone to move over to the fan page. And also feel free to friend us as individuals on Facebook. We love to meet listeners and talk to them online as well.
And since I haven't mentioned it in a while, if you're looking for something to buy, go to the Teaching Company, look for the course Medical Myths, Lies, and Half-Truths by yours truly. This is a 24-lecture course available both audio and video. You can either have it shipped to you or you can download it. Give it a look. You can get to it through the Neurological blog. There's a link to it in the middle column. And Rebecca will be joining us again next week.
Thank God. She'll be back on
the East Coast. We missed her this week.
Well, what about the whole rapture thing? I mean, what, you know, if there is a next week,
yeah,
we should qualify that.
Yeah, I'll take my chances.
Yeah, right. Don't sell the farm yet.
Right. Well, thanks for joining me again this week, guys.
Sure.
Thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Steve.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. You can also check out our other podcast, the SGU 5x5, as well as find links to our blogs and the SGU forums. For questions, suggestions and other feedback, please use the Contact Us form on the website, or send an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. If you enjoyed this episode, then please help us spread the word by leaving us a review on iTunes, Zune, or your portal of choice.